Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Oh, Grace, I don't know.
Diane sighed into the phone.
I'm sure the boys would love to go to the game, but it's Phil's weekend on that date, so... Well, he might be flexible, but... I know, but with a divorce, it's so complicated coordinating schedules. And that's why we have to plan things so far in advance, yeah. It is crazy, and no one can be sick or have an emergency or anything, or the whole schedule just collapses. Yeah, it is ironic now. We're consulting with each other more than we ever did before. Go figure. I will ask him about that weekend, but don't expect anything.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about co-parenting in divorce? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest works with families who are dealing with separation and divorce issues. Risa Garin is Executive Director and co-founder of the National Family Resiliency Center, Incorporated, in Maryland, a private, nonprofit mental health center serving children and families in transition. She is a certified mediator and has received advanced training in collaborative law. Risa serves as a divorce coach and child development expert. In her clinical work, she sees individuals, couples, and families, and facilitates therapy groups for women and adolescents. She developed the child and family-focused model of decision-making, which supports the best interest of the child and is utilized in training best interest attorneys, judges, mediators, and mental health professionals around the country. Risa and the NFRC staff use the model in their work with parents to create child-focused parent plans. Risa has authored and co-authored numerous publications, chapters, and books, and she has two grown children of her own. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Risa.
Thank you for inviting me.
What would you say is the biggest challenge to co-parenting in divorce?
I think the biggest challenge to co-parenting after separation and divorce is being able to put aside one's adult relationship and all the feelings, particularly grief, the loss of the picture of family you had, the anger that you may feel because perhaps you didn't want the divorce, and needing at the same time you're dealing with financial, legal, social, psychological pressures and stresses, you're having to focus on your children and talk to someone you really may not want to talk to.
That sounds like a lot of big challenges.
It's a lot, and it's a lot at the same time. And there's been a lot of research that shows the impact neurologically of the grief process on decision making. So during this very stressful time, when you can see scans that show the brain working very differently, we're having parents make major decisions that impact them and their children for the rest of their lives.
How do you compensate for that? That sounds like a very scary thing.
It is a very scary thing, and I think it's something that our society hasn't attended to. The fact that there are significant changes and demands on parents and children. What we try to do is offer a lot of support. Our belief in, and it's why we have the name resiliency, is that all families need and deserve support going through difficult times in their particular life cycle. Being surrounded by caring family members, by the faith community, by seeking psychological support, I think that's one way. Helping families to reality test if a parent is really angry and says, I never want my child to have access to the other parent. One has to question that parent. Is that how you want your child to remember his or her childhood? How do you think you might feel if this happened to you? So that we try to help families, parents especially, think about their situations and the impact of their decisions on their children.
How do women's and men's preconceptions about this situation differ?
I think there are definitely some differences between the genders, although I have seen over the years kind of a coming together. We work with as many men as we do women. We've seen fathers become increasingly as active and involved and responsible and loving as moms. I think for moms, a difference is it's really hard, particularly if moms have been stay-at-home moms, and they're sharing now more of a nurturing role with dad, and the worries of, you know, will my Jimmy have his Blankie and stuffed animals? Will my older kids have enough adequate food? Will they get to the games on time? I think sometimes that it's a little easier for women in terms of all the multitasking that they do. But again, to the credit of dads, I've seen dads play just as equal a role and significant a role. I think that's really faded over time, which is why in our country, at least, there's a lot more shared legal and shared physical custody.
So it sounds like in the real world, things actually can be better in a way in terms of sharing than they were before a divorce.
Well, that's a very good point, because what I find is that sometimes we'll start working with parents who never communicated as parents. And now they have two homes, their same children in two different houses. They have to communicate. And what we really try to do is help them develop what I call a new script, to put aside, as I said before, their adult relationship and focus on, let's talk every Thursday night about the following: how our kids are doing in school, who their latest friends are, what their activities are for the week, how have their moods been. Imagine if you were asked to switch homes every 2 days and maybe you had an ear infection and you weren't feeling up to par. Parents need to know the nuances of their children and share that with each other. So I think you're really right that parents often improve their communication significantly.
Are there really legal arrangements where children go from one home to the other for just a few days at a time?
Oh, absolutely. There are many legal arrangements where there are some children who transfer homes every day, which I think is incredibly taxing on the children. But especially for younger children, there's often a plan: 2 days on with the parent, 2 days off with the other parent, coming back, alternating weekends. And for younger children, that works well, because younger children really miss their other parents, so being away from either parent becomes very difficult. But then again, imagine packing your toys, suitcases, if you're older, school books, teenage girls, all their makeup and their hair dryers and this and that, what that must do. And it's very difficult for many kids. And yet for other kids whose temperament may be a little more flexible and change isn't that difficult, it becomes very much part of their lives.
I can't imagine my children living out of a suitcase.
It's very difficult. As one favorite judge of mine said to a group of parents at a seminar, how would you like to switch homes every day or every other day, pack your suitcase, have to remember your work clothes and your work papers, and then just get to work and pretend everything's great?
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on co-parenting for divorced parents.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Risa Garin about co-parenting for divorced parents. What's the best way for divorcing parents to begin co-parenting?
That is such an important and very significant question. The very best way for parents is, one, to select a legal process to become aware of all their choices, which many parents aren't. Many parents in the throes of a separation will say, just give me the name of an attorney, I'm going to fight this out in court. The best judges will plead with parents not to go to court, not to go to trial. They will say, you don't want me to make decisions about your children. You know your children the best and love them the most. Your children are strangers to me. So the non-adversarial processes that we advocate, one is mediation. The other is collaborative law, which is a relatively recent legal choice for parents, which involves a multidisciplinary team of attorneys, neutral financial divorce advisors, mental health professionals who serve very specific roles, either that of a divorce coach to help parents communicate with each other, handle meetings together, and also a child specialist, which is one of my favorite roles in the collaborative process, because it gives children a voice and it helps parents develop what I call a roadmap to help them through the different stages of divorce and focus on their children.
Can you explain a child specialist a little bit more?
In the collaborative process, or even if parents choose another process, a child specialist is someone who's been educated in child development and has experience working clinically with many families going through transition. That person meets with parents to work with them to better understand the needs of each child in the family. by discussing one child at a time and understanding the uniqueness, the challenges, for example, that one child might have in school, another may have another issue in another area. Children of different ages have different needs. We work on each child and we develop what we call a customized approach, a customized plan for each child. The child specialist in the collaborative process also meets with the children, not as a therapist, and the children are informed that the information they're sharing is not confidential. But what it does is that it gives children a voice. When I'm a child specialist, I don't say to a child, tell me who you really want to live with. That's obviously taboo. But what you want to do is get a sense of who is this child. Through this child's eyes, how has this child experienced the separation process up until now? Is he tense and worried and angry because he's in the middle between his parents? Is he cool about it and thinking everything's fine? Is he or she worried about will they be able to live in the same house and graduate from the same high school? And we talk to the kids and let them know we'll be speaking to their parents about what it is that would help them the most. That's how I usually phrase it. What can we do to help you through this process and in your relationship with each parent? And it's really amazing what children will discuss. They're usually very honest and appreciative of having this opportunity.
How does someone go about finding a mediator or an arbitrator or a person who can help them find a collaborative team? You're in the throes of all that you described earlier, the real trauma of this kind of experience. And I can understand the natural reaction of, I'm going to get my lawyer, which is a very harsh way to go about it. But at the same time, you're not in a psychological framework where you would say, okay, now let me find out what organizations can help me.
You're absolutely correct that this is such a stressful time that people don't have time to read. They don't have time to think about what you just said. So I believe ethically it's the responsibility of all mental health professionals, attorneys, judges, and family. Family can make it or break it for the children, and by that I mean extended family. Mm-hmm. If you say you don't have to take those kids to the family reunion, that family shouldn't have access to my grandchild or my niece or nephew, what you're doing is you're forming a war and you're joining the battle. What you really want are people who will say, you know what, are you aware? Are you familiar with collaborative law? Why don't you Google collaborative law and read about it and find out about it? There are national organizations and in each jurisdiction, and I know this is broadcast all over. Even in Europe, they have collaborative law. So you Google, you read about it. There are phone numbers, there are websites, and you can become informed. The difference between collaborative law and mediation is that in mediation, you have a neutral person working usually solo or with a co-mediator, and that person is working with both parents. In collaborative law, you have one attorney for each parent, so you have two attorneys, the mental health team, the financial team, and you are really working as a team. I believe it takes a village to raise a child. I believe it takes a team to work together with a family. And we have just seen amazing results where parents who weren't talking when they first started are talking. They're working together when their children are in crises and not in crises. They develop beautiful parent agreements. And I think there's something else that's very special that occurs in collaborative law. A team works together for the benefit of the family. It's not, I'm on an island and I think I know it all doing this mental health work, when I need to collaborate with the attorneys and understand what they're doing, and we all communicate very frequently for the benefit of the families.
In what way can or should the children be involved? I assume they really can't be given decision-making responsibility.
Absolutely. I think, Sandy, that what you just said is so critical. Children cannot think or assume that they're going to be the decision makers. They are really relieved when they're told, you will not make the decision. Mom and dad or the two parents involved will be making the decision. We like to hear what would work for you. For example, if we have kids on teams all over the world, we have different soccer teams and kids have lots of practices and lots of homework. And if a child says, as one child just said to me recently, a teenager, I can't do it anymore. I can't do every few days like we were talking about before. And so I said, what would help you? What would work for you? And she said, 1 week on, 1 week off. That's where a child's voice needs to be heard, where you can say, I can promise you nothing, but we all want to hear what's important to you and what's working for you and what's not working for you. And that's where I think a child needs to be included, not in terms of what decision should we make, which has happened, and that really backfires and is very detrimental to children.
With the exception of families where the children are all grown up or where there are babies, how can a child's school be supportive?
I think that school can be supportive in so many ways, and we've had the pleasure of training guidance counselors nationally and locally, working with teachers, working with administrators. One of the best activities that counselors do with kids is have a group for kids at school for families in transition. And it normalizes the experience for children. It teaches them coping skills. I also think educating the whole faculty about language to use. I'll give you an example. The other day we had an experience where a child was crying because he was asked about why parents weren't together anymore, and it was stressful enough for this child. Language, broken home. One would think that was gone decades ago. It's not. It's still used, and we hear that sometimes. So I think counselors educating faculties, sometimes we'll go in and we'll have a seminar with faculties to talk about the kind of language, what they can do. I also think there's another significant part that school professionals play, and that is limiting the conflict between parents. Oftentimes we get calls from counselors or teachers saying, I'm having a conference, I'm dreading it. The Smiths are coming in and they're notorious for their screaming matches. And what I have learned in my work and what I advocate other professionals to do is not accept that, to start from the beginning to say, we are here to focus on Johnny. These are the rules for communication. No interrupting. We need to speak to each other with respect. No judgment. And then actually follow through with that, that if one interrupts the other, say, excuse me, you're interrupting. And that seems to keep the conflict down.
What about duplicate report cards or communiques from the school to the parents?
I think that most schools have a requirement that duplicate report cards be sent out, or minimally parents can request it. I know that we experience at our center a lot of parents fighting about, you didn't tell me that there was a special dinner for the soccer team. Mm-hmm. You didn't tell me this. And what we say to parents is you need to take that responsibility. As you know, schools have so many different activities and stresses themselves that they just can't remember, oh, I forgot to tell Mary Smith to tell her dad that this or tell her mom that. So we ask parents to keep in touch with the school.
And I guess the people who are in charge of other activities like coaches or music teachers.
Yes, and I also think that's another area that still could make some changes in a positive direction. If a child doesn't have a parent to bring to the parent banquet, change the name. It doesn't have to be, this is the mom or dad banquet night. This is your family banquet night, and you could bring grandma, grandpa, you can bring Uncle Tom, you can bring the next door neighbor, because children feel so isolated. And I think that's still a little bit of a stigma that's left.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on co-parenting for divorced parents.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Risa Guerin about co-parenting for divorced parents.
Would you give some examples of co-parenting issues that you've seen creatively resolved?
Sometimes people say to me, you've probably seen it all. Sometimes I think so, but I learn more and more each day. I'm going to share a developmental perspective. There's a lot of controversy in the field about infant overnights. So if parents come to us and they have an infant, it's, I want my infant to stay with me at my house. And we all know it takes time to develop, to become attached. Little infants like to nestle into their own little place. And there is in the field a controversy. It's no big deal. Get used to it. And then there's an opposing view. What we do is we take a graduated approach. So I'll give you two examples where there were infants born and the parents were not together. And one parent was the caregiver and the other parent wanted to have the child. And we worked out a plan where at first this parent would go to the other parent's home where the infant was and learn to take care of the infant, learn to play with it, to provide stimulation, change its diaper, feed it, put it in for a nap, be there when the child woke up, and then increasingly that parent spent more time. And then we graduated after 2 or 3 months to taking the child out for several hours. Now that child at 6 months is able to spend a whole day with the parent and very shortly will spend an overnight, and that will increase. And again, the difference is this is a child-focused approach. It's different from the old traditional adversarial, the baby's mine too, and I'm taking the baby and the baby's staying with me without consideration to who is this baby, what does this baby need. So that's one example. Another example, I thought this was something beautiful that parents did. One of the teenagers was graduating from high school, and one of the parents lived out of town. And like most kids, this teenager wanted to have a graduation party. The parent whose home the child resided in had remarried, and they wanted to throw a big bash at their home. But in consideration of the other parent, we brainstormed creative solutions and said, let's have it at a park where everybody could participate, and they informed the other parent ahead of time so this parent could play just as significant a role. It was less stressful than going into another parent's and new step-parent's territory, and it worked out really, really well. There are, for little children, as we talked about, let's say young elementary school children, 5 through 8, where sometimes getting on the wrong bus has happened and they're terrified when they get to one parent's house and they're supposed to be at the other's and the parents are terrified too, where the kids are all mixed up. They're supposed to do their homework. They don't know where their folders are. So we work with parents to come up with systems where parents check, and this is why it's so important for parents to continue to communicate with each other so that they can be aware of what their children need. And they just got some creative folders and they labeled it and they had pictures on it so their son would be able to figure out, okay, this is my folder. I need to take this out of my book bag and do my homework, but this is for my parents and they're going to take care of it. And that worked out really well. We've also had parents who live in different countries and have very creative agreements made where one parent would go to the other parent's country to make sure the children had a healthy, safe, secure transition. So it wasn't just dropping off to, okay, get on the plane and have a good summer, but it was, let's make sure everything's okay and you can see your parents working together and so forth.
It's interesting. As I listen to this, it almost sounds like children who go through this kind of co-parenting experience come out more organized than most children. Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, that's a very good question. I think in some cases, yes. I think in some cases, especially if children have some executive functioning difficulties, it's made it more difficult for them. I will tell you that I have found that children going through transitions, if they have the right kind of support, such as some kind of psychological support and the love and support of their parents and their parents getting along, those children are often healthier than children who are residing in intact families where all the problems are put under the rug and no one talks to each other. But you say, well, I'm from an intact family. But in terms of looking from the outside in, some of the skills, the ability to express feelings, to cope, to solve problems, to be more flexible, I think are really consequences, results that we see in many families.
Sounds like maybe this co-parenting stuff would be good for everybody to go through without having to be divorced.
I think so. One of the tools that we've developed in terms of resources is a program called Family Connects. You can access that on www.familyconnects.org. And it's an online program that gives parents tools to do at their leisure, to do separately. It's not a contest to see who knows the children the best. But it is a tool to help parents look at the needs of their children and from that determine what both parents can address and put into a parent agreement. And parents work very hard at that. We all did this, kind of tested the program with our own children. And it's very thorough, and it's far more than a schedule, which many parents want more than a schedule, but they don't know how to, as you said before, find the resources to help them.
We're almost ready to conclude our show, but is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with that we haven't discussed?
Yes, thank you for asking that question. I would like to leave your listeners with a sense of hope. This is such a difficult time, and I know from working with many individuals and families, even getting out of bed sometimes is very difficult facing. This is a whole new life. Divorce takes on a life of its own, and you still have to go to work, cook dinner, get your kids to school, help them. And if you allow yourself to receive support from your family, friends, community, if you seek some kind of psychological support, if you make up your mind you are going to put the adult relationship aside and focus on your children, they will be fine and you will be fine.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've been discussing?
I think additional resources, there are tons of books all over in the library. There's a wonderful book on collaborative law by Stuart Webb, W-E-B-B, and another book by Pauline Tessler, T-E-S-S-L-E-R. There are lots of excellent books about mediation. Your listeners might want to access our website, www.nfrchelp.org, because it is rich in resources, not only about what we offer regarding books, Family Connects, but also resources outside of our center. Your listeners are welcome to call me, Risa Guerin, 301-384-0079, extension 203.
And we have to remind all our listeners, especially ones who are on the West Coast, that that's the Eastern time zone. We're so fortunate that Risa Guerin from the National Family Resiliency Center was able to be with us today and to give us not only the ideas of things we can implement, but also hope. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 367. Spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. And tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from our listeners. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.